I hope that makes sense to everyone, and I think that means that we're ready to proceed. So this is cause number 03-21-214-CV, Terry Burns, MD, and Stephen Rapkin versus the City of San Antonio, Texas, acting by and through the City Public Service Board of San Antonio, Texas, et al. And for the appellant?
Yes, ma'am. Darby Riding for Terry Burns and Steve Rapkin.
And for appellee?
Your Honor, Mike O'Donnell for the City of San Antonio, acting by and through the City Public Service Board.
And I want to, like, call the state intervener, but I don't know what. Are y'all appellee or?
We are procedurally an appellee, Your Honor.
Procedurally an appellee, but you're kind of going in odd time, and everyone is understands what we're doing here with the time? Okay, so and for the state of Texas then?
Southern McDaniel on behalf of the state of Texas and General Office.
Thank you. Thank you. And Mr. Riley, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. The main point that I wanted to make, the dispositive point, is that there's no subject matter jurisdiction in the trial court. CPS Energy, acting for its owner, the City of San Antonio, unlawfully obtained a declaratory judgment and a permanent injunction against a city charter amendment before it could be submitted to the voters for approval. If the additional signatures had been obtained for the charter amendment, and if it had been approved by the voters, it would significantly alter the policies and the direction of the city's energy utility. The citizens' constitutional right to put this political question to the San Antonio voters was violated by the trial court's order. Since 1912, the Texas Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that with respect to citizen-initiated charter amendments, the election is held first and the questions concerning the amendments are litigated later.
Mr. Riley, before we get into that, because I know we want to talk about that, but the first thing you said is the trial court did not have subject matter jurisdiction, correct?
Right.
So if that is the case, what relief is it that you are asking this court for? Because usually if there's no subject matter jurisdiction in the court below, we're limited to one thing and one thing only that we can do here.
That's dismiss the case as
correct.
Void. It's a void judgment.
Correct. And when I look at your prayer, it doesn't exactly say that. That's why I want some clarification.
That's what we're asking. That's what we're asking.
Okay.
Is that the court declare this to be a void judgment.
Can we? Can we do that? Can we declare it a void judgment, or do we simply just have to say, well, this?
I've cited a case or two, Your Honor, in which this court has done exactly that and just dismissed the case outright as being an invalid judgment. Three big Supreme Court cases, City of Dallas versus Dallas Consolidated Electric Railway, 1912, right when these charter amendments started. City of Austin versus Thompson, 1949, and Colson versus City Council of Victoria, 1980. So about every 30 to 40 years, this situation comes up. But it's always the same answer because there's only one answer. There are two significant independent reasons for holding that there is no jurisdiction in the trial court. First, it's an advisory opinion. The signatures might not be gathered. The voters might not approve it. It's not a justiciable controversy. That was clearly pointed out by the Supreme Court in 1912. And secondly, they pointed out, it violates the separation of powers between the legislative and judiciary functions of government. I cited a Supreme Court case that says this: every step and proceeding necessary to complete an election is the exercise of political power, and during its progress is not subject to judicial control. The trial court's issuance of this advisory opinion, which blocked the citizens' right to act as citizen legislators in the exercise of political power, is void The trial court's judgment is void and should be set aside by this court. The second point I wanted to make, the procedural point. This court has the power to set aside the trial court's void judgment, even though it wasn't appealed within 20 days of the judgment under the Expedited Declaratory Judgment Act. In fact, the proponents were not even notified of the judgment until 30 days after it had been signed by the judge, when there was a media announcement by CPS Energy. So this case gives significant or clear reasons to follow this Magnolia case.
So let's talk about the notice a little bit, because I mean there's some due process considerations in there for why notice would be required. What is the property interest? What is the interest that is at issue here that would require not just notice by publication, but other notice?
The issue is that the proponents are not have a separate standing other than the general public, because they have put out their sweat and the blood to get these signatures and to create this amendment. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that they have independent standing. They're not like just everybody in the public, as CPS has argued in this case, that there's no difference between the proponents and the rest of the citizens. The people who actually go out and do this have standing, and the Supreme Court in each of these cases, for example, in the Victoria case, City of Victoria, it was just an unincorporated group had standing to come in and sue to put this thing on the ballot. The court, even though there was a pretty strong argument it was invalid, but the court said it doesn't matter. You have to let it go forward. And once it passes the voters, then you have a justiciable controversy. Then you can challenge it in court.
But procedurally, y'all didn't institute this suit procedurally.
We didn't do what, Your Honor?
You didn't institute the suit procedurally.
Though. No.
Right. Okay.
We filed a motion for new trial under 329. Right. That's the only thing we did. But 329 should be applied here. To extend the plenary power of the trial court to set aside a void judgment under the Expedited Declaratory Judgments Act. And here's three different reasons. First, as a void advisory opinion, it's not a valid EDJA bond validation proceeding, and so it's not subject to the expedited procedures of 1205.068 of the government code. That's of the EDJA. And kind of related to that, the suit's subject matter doesn't fit within the stated purposes of the EDJA under 1205.021, which lists about 8 or 10 different ways you can bring these suits, these in rem, expedited. This case was filed and 25 days later, it's final judgment. That's how quick this suit is. 1205.021 does not contemplate a suit to protect the credit rating of the bond issuer. And it doesn't contemplate litigating whether a bond covenant would be violated by a potential legislative enactment. It's therefore not a valid EDJA suit, and so not subject to those expedited procedures. In City of Conroe versus San Jacinto River Authority last year, the Supreme Court held that the trial court did not have jurisdiction under the EDJA to determine whether the issuer complied with the bond contracts when it set the rates for its customers. Here, there is no jurisdiction under the EDJA to determine whether potential charter amendments might violate bond covenants. It's a breach of contract type claim. And the court says that's not what we're looking at in EDJA. This has to do with the initial authorization and issuance of the bonds, and not with this type of dispute. There's a case from this court in 2015 that hadn't been cited. It's Guadalupe Blanco River Authority versus Texas Attorney General, 2015, Westlaw 868871, petition denied. In that case, the GBRA sued to block several entities from using some of the water that it needed to sell to pay its bonds. So the GBRA is saying, well, that's, it's related to our bonds. The court said that doesn't bear on the legality and the validity of the bonds. It's entirely outside the scope of the EDJA. And so they dismissed the case. And this is similar here to this case where Judge Sulak said that his one of his first findings is that this is a valid, these are valid and bonds that have been issued. The standard language under the EDJA, that was also in this case. So that was a valid statement. It just wasn't contested by anybody, and the court dismissed the whole case. That's kind of been an issue by CPS. They're saying, well, a little bit of our judgment might be valid, so you should not throw out the whole thing. But the substance of the case is in invalid basis for suing under the EDJA. In that case, here's a quote from this court. It says, this appeal does not concern whether the issuing power has the authority to issue the public securities, whether the securities were properly authorized, whether the procedures for issuing the securities were complied with, or whether the securities and the proposed expenditures are legal and valid. In other words, those are the categories of the EDJA. None of those categories fit here either. It's just a very similar analysis.
Counselor, can I take you back to Magnolia real quick?
Pardon me?
Magnolia. You brought up the Magnolia case out of this court. And so it's your position that 329 applies here, and I guess my question to that is, if that's the case, which of the three Magnolia opinions, because there's two concurrings and a dissent, support your position that 329 is applicable here?
City of Magnolia case? Which,
yes.
Which one is correct of
yes.
the two decisions?
Which one supports your position that it would apply in this case? Because I'm assuming that your position is that 329 applies, and you already referred it earlier to the Magnolia case, and I just want to kind of flesh that out a little bit.
Your Honor, the Magnolia case applies both ways that the court decided it. The first, Justice Triana just said Rule 329 is available to anybody in a EDJA case. And the reason that is because the Rule 329 has a good cause catch in it. In other words, if you bring a Rule 329 motion a year and a half after the EDJA judgment, you're going to have to show good cause, and essentially that means this is a void judgment for one reason or another, and that's what happened in Magnolia, and that's what's happening here. So Rule 329 should apply in every EDJA case. It's just, I mean, it should be allowed to apply if there is an argument for good cause, that is good cause to set the judgment aside. That's what we have here. And so
that's not the way Chief Justice Rose went in Magnolia, however.
No, that's right, Your Honor. Justice Rose said that I don't have to go there because there's a violation of due process here. This was these people had a valid church-related objection, and
they had an actual property interest unique to them that was not the same as every other citizen.
I think so, Your Honor. That's right. It was different from regular taxpayers.
Right.
Yeah. And so in here we have a liberty interest that is different from regular taxpayers. A very clear constitutional liberty interest.
And how do your clients have such an interest, if so?
Because they're both active proponents of the Charter Amendment. That's the standard under these cases the court has looked at, all of those cases involving charter fights like this. Colson, for example, and other cases, anybody who signed the petition has a standing to bring that suit, and they have this is a constitutional right that they have to propose this charter amendment, and it's protected by Texas courts. This right under Article 5 and 1 and 2 of the Texas Constitution gives separate standing to the amendment proponents, entitles them to actual notice of the suit before court action is taken. Since the judgment was taken without actual notice, it violated due process and is void. So that's the third way, Your Honor, but that's not even necessary for a finding of a void judgment. If this thing's outside the scope of the EDJA, it's void. And as I say, if it is an advisory opinion, which that's what it is, it also, there's no jurisdiction for that. And that's everywhere in every court. That's the facts. You can't do an advisory opinions. So there's no jurisdiction over the subject.
Mr. Riley, I just want to make sure that you appreciate that you're kind of eating it. You're eating into your rebuttal time.
I'll wait my time.
It's your time. You can use it wherever, whichever place you'd like.
Just go ahead and finish. I had a little bit more here I'd like to say. I've said that Rule 329 requiring good cause is a good vehicle to invoke this court's jurisdiction. The good cause requirement protects valid EDJA judgments. But if a good cause is shown to invalidate the judgment, as here and in Magnolia, the court has the power and the duty to set it aside. The sad and shameful fact is that the city and its utility abused its power, used public money to successfully prevent a public debate and vote on a charter amendment in violation of its own citizens' constitutional rights. Texas courts have never approved such an action. It's in essence, it's a strategic lawsuit against public participation, a slap suit. We ask this court to declare the judgment void and of no effect.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Sundar McDaniel, and I represent the Attorney General's office in this case. As this court has been made aware, the Attorney General's office here is serving in a limited capacity due to the nature of EDJA actions. We rarely step in on the merits, and in this case, only weigh in on the matters and the legal issues that we feel need to be addressed to the court. For that reason, we filed a brief in this court to address one single issue between the appellants and the appellees, and that is the application of Rule 329 to EDJA actions. Our position is simple. As this court stated in Magnolia, 329 does apply when due process requires it. We take no position on the merits today about whether or not the appellants here had such liberty or private property interests sufficient to give them the new trial, but we do take the position that the trial court did have jurisdiction to at least hear the issue and consider the matter for review.
Hear the issue of the EDJA or hear the issue of the 329 motion?
I just
want to make sure what which one we're y'all are conceding or making the point that that's why we're here.
Yes, Your Honor. It's the 329 action.
329.
When an EDJA action may implicate a private right, 329 is simply the procedural vehicle that allows an individual to then come before the court to simply have that right considered by the court to determine if there was such a violation and if the judgment should be set aside.
Did the trial court have jurisdiction?
Over the 329 action, Your Honor?
Well, jurisdiction over the EDJA action.
Well, I
think he's asking what I just asked in a different way.
I was trying to ask you similarly to the way it was framed by counsel.
Yes,
I failed or didn't succeed at that.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is we actually take no position on that question. We were at the trial level and we would have objected to the trial court's jurisdiction if we felt that necessary at the time to do so. We take no position on any of the other matters. It's really whether or not 329 allows the parties to bring their rights to the court to consider the issue.
Thank you for that clarification. Now keep going.
Yes, my apologies.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And on that matter, we are of the position, of course, that this court's Magnolia decision does apply. Certainly, Magnolia is a plurality decision, and Justice Rose and Justice Triana have come to the position with different angles. However, there is one clear point in Magnolia, which is that 329 is at least applicable. Now, why it is still up for debate. And we just take the position today that it is the procedural vehicle to allow those individuals to come before the court. And we would further take the position that that's the good cause issue that really matters. And if there was a void judgment or if there is a violation of a privately held liberty or property interest by the judgment, then that would be sufficient good cause to set aside the judgment. But that's really all that 329 is meant to do. It is a procedural vehicle to allow a party to come before the court to simply have that matter reviewed.
And you're not taking a position on the ultimate issue of whether or not good cause was shown or whether or not there is a property interest?
That is correct.
An issue in this case?
That is correct, Justice Goodman. We have no position on that or any of the other merits issues or the issues that the appellees and the appellants have brought up in their briefs. It's simply limited to the one question, does 329 apply? Okay. And we are the position that it does. Unless there are any further questions from this court, I thank the court for its time and will yield my time back.
May it please the court. The difference between the appellant's position and the appellee's position is a fundamental difference in understanding of what the city sought in the first place and what the city obtained through this judgment. The judgment, when we look at the language of the judgment, falls squarely within Chapter 1205 of the Government Code. Mr. Riley is correct that the principal case we look at for that point is the City of San Jacinto River Authority case. And what that case says is that it is the role of the court to look for an authorizing connection between the act in question and the public securities. Justice Busby was clear that any ordinance or rule that is part of the initial actions and approvals needed for proper issuance of securities is squarely within Chapter 1205. The ordinances that were validated and declared legal by the court's judgment are the ordinances that are legally required to be in place prior to the city issuing the debt. They are what the Attorney General reviews to make sure that the transcript of proceedings is complete and legal and approves. And so they have the most ultimate authorizing connection because they are the document without which the public securities could not be issued in the first place. Chapter 1205 reflects the strong policy of the legislature to drive finality and certainty into bond transactions in general for the purposes of keeping the cost of borrowing low for the benefits of the citizens of Bexar County and every other county and allowing public works dollars to go as far as they possibly can go.
I have two questions.
Yes, sir.
One question, is publication proper service in this case? Second question, is there a constitutionally protected liberty interest at stake in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me focus on those two points. First, The fundamental issues that came up during the trial were provisions of the bond ordinances that established the governance of the utility, term limits, the ability to amend, and what procedures are required to amend those ordinances. Those were all guaranteed by state law. The city had a right under the Public Works Code Article 1115 to include those things in the ordinances. Those issues are public interest issues. Nobody has a particularized right in how a utility is governed that we all share the services of. Nobody has an individual liberty or property interest in term limits, in amendment procedures. These are things that are of general public interest. The case
quick,
that we
quick
cite.
Follow up. Yes. Sorry to interrupt you. At some point in your presentation, try to distinguish Magnolia from this case if as you can.
Yes, sir. So I'm going to continue on this line.
Sure.
So I can try
sure.
to bring it
sorry.
To conclusion. 2 points I want to talk about. First, there's a case we cite called Jackson versus Waller ISD, which I think is the most comprehensive look at this idea of publication notice for the EDJA. And it says that no person has a constitutionally protected right to challenge a bond ordinance. There is no liberty interest involved in that whatsoever. There's no exclusive property right. If I'm a challenger, I can't exclude anyone else from bringing a similar challenge. And no one has any monetary interest whatsoever in challenging a bond. Only public interests are at stake. Now, when we look at the Magnolia opinion, the court was very clear, Justice Rose was very clear, that there was a unique set of facts in that case. There was a discriminatory rate placed upon nonprofit institutions. And there was a set of facts concerning a level of dispute already existing between the churches and the city. Beyond that, the churches were asserting specific causes of action under both the Constitution and statutory laws protecting religious freedom. It's completely different than this case. So when Mr. Riley says that his clients, who are just two individuals in San Antonio who are relying upon their status as voters to be here in the first place, when he says that they have a particularized liberty interest, they have no greater liberty interest than anyone else who resides in San Antonio, including myself. And when we provide notice through publication, we provide notice to everyone. And that is very critical because there's different constituent groups here. There are folks who are in favor of CPS Energy and the charter amendments, folks who are against that. There are bondholders who have an interest in this. So we have no ability to pick and choose under the statute who to provide personal service or personal notice to. You do it as a group. And I think anything else leads to a slippery slope because if we inform a couple of people but don't inform other people, it's impossible to enforce the statute, but the Texas legislature has given us a mandate and has given us a method to achieve due process, which is through public notice, which we did in the San Antonio Express News, Austin American Statesman, five other papers we didn't need to, but we tried to publish it as much as we could. And having done these cases, many times there are people who come forward. Many times there are people who see the issue and choose not to come forward.
Let me ask you another question. Was Magnolia properly decided that 329 applies to EDJA actions?
Well, I wouldn't say it wasn't properly decided because there was no consensus on that issue.
Sure.
So I believe.
But everybody agreed, kind of, that it goes somewhere, right? That 329 has some application. It's just, what does it look like?
Well, Justice Baker's opinion is that 329 is not applicable to the EDJA, and it's not applicable for a number of reasons. One, it only applies to named defendants. These two appellants chose not to become named defendants. The statute tells you how you can become one. You file an answer before the trial, you can intervene after the trial, or file an appeal. They did none of those things. And the reason they didn't do those things is because once someone becomes a party, as Justice Busby's explained, they are required to post a bond to participate in this litigation. These appellants never became parties and they never posted a bond. 329 only applies to a defendant. Beyond that, the statute, Chapter 1205, states that if you go through this publication process, the court has the same jurisdiction as if all interested persons had been personally served. That's the decision our legislature has made. And so I don't think that there is a consensus among 329. Justice Rose's opinion, you have to sort out a little bit to try to understand. But realize there, what he was doing is he did not find error in a decision of a trial court to grant a new trial. Here, there's been a full trial, a full slate of evidence. There has been a motion for a new trial that has been denied. And so it is a slightly different procedural posture than what was in Magnolia.
And so you're saying there's no defendant in this case at all?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. There's no named party. So a couple other points I wanted to focus on are the applicability of the act to the judgment, which I think is critical because what Mr. Riley is saying is that the judgment enjoins a charter amendment process. It enjoins an election. It enjoins filing a charter. Facially, none of that is contained within the judgment. And in fact, the city, in the course of the transcript, was very clear that we were asking for validation of the bond ordinances and nothing more, and that we were not asking for an injunction with respect to the charter process. What we were asking was for these core provisions of the ordinances, which had been promised to the investors that they could at least rely on the validity of those. Those core provisions, based on the Texas statutes and its Public Utilities Code 1115 was what was in effect in 1942 when the first time this was enacted. And it makes clear that the city was entitled during the time that the systems are encumbered, during that entire period of time, to make a long-term commitment by the terms of the encumbrance, the ordinance that actually encumbers the revenue of the system, could place in the hands of a board of trustees to be named in such encumbrance consisting of not more than five members. That's the board of trustees, the governance that was promised to the investors. And if you think about it, these bonds are priced on day one. So it's a 30-year investment that the investor is pricing based upon the terms, conditions, and covenants that are being promised to them. Their fundamental expectation is that the rules of the game, the terms of the investment, are not going to change midstream until the investment is paid off. And that's specifically what the Texas legislature guaranteed here. I get a sense from the briefing, particularly the reply, that the appellants are taking the position, well, governance is somehow superfluous to all this, that it's not part of what makes a bond a financial instrument. And our position is they're absolutely fundamental terms. The only way the investors can get repaid here, the only security they have for their investment, is the net revenue of the system after the utility pays off all of its operating expenses. So how that utility is managed, whether it's managed by an independent board of trustees which with term limits that support institutional knowledge, means a lot as to whether the investor's risk in terms of getting back her principal and protecting the return. And it's a critical provision. The city had very good reason to proceed when it did. The briefing takes issue with a Fitch report, but there was an independent credit ratings report that found that the charter petition posed a potential additional risk to the city. And a potential risk is a risk, period. And it was in connection with that independent agency, Fitch, issuing a negative outlook. Judge Shulock heard extensively from three witnesses, executive in the finance department of CPS Energy, bond counsel, and Dan Hartman. He's one of the leading financial advisors to utilities in the United States. And he explained at a scorecard level how rating agencies look at particular situations like this, a threat of breach of covenants, the issue a threat to independent governance. And he showed the court at a scorecard level how the rating agencies would, how that would impact credit ratings. And that bringing certainty to the market through a 1205 proceeding was critical at that point in time. And bringing that certainty, he translated it into real dollars. CPS Energy has to issue new debt. in 2021, if there's even a slight change in their credit rating, the smallest incremental move in interest rates could cost $325,000. Mr. Hartman testified that a 1.53% change in rates, which had been seen in the recent past, would have cost $48 million to the city and its citizens based upon the plan in terms of spending. The judgment does not enjoin an election, period. When you look at the cases cited by Mr. Riley, the Colson case, City of Dallas versus Dallas Consolidated, City of Austin versus Thompson, those involved actual injunctions. City of Dallas, the city was being prevented from actually canvassing the results of an election that had occurred. City of Austin, the city was being enjoined from expending any funds on a special election that had been authorized. Those are facially injunctions against an election. Here, there's no injunction against an essential function of an election like canvassing results or essential support like being able to have money. The injunction that was issued tracks the statute exactly. It tracks section 1205.151C. This court in ex parte City of El Paso found error when the trial court did not include all three elements of injunctive relief. The trial court had left off that there would be an injunction of any matter that could have been raised in the action. And by leaving that out, the trial judge was found to have committed error. The fact that Judge Shulock followed the statute and followed the court's teaching in City of El Paso, there cannot possibly be error associated with that. If he hadn't said anything about the injunction, the statute would have had the same effect. The statute would have given that judgment the same effect because it says the judgment is a permanent injunction against certain challenges. There's also no evidence here of an actual impact on anything the proponents of the charter petition were doing. If you look at Appendix G to the appellant's brief, that's their declarations of the appellants. And it doesn't say that they stopped gathering signatures. It doesn't say that they stopped their process. And in fact, the claim seems to be that the city delayed in making people aware of it. So the city clearly wasn't using this judgment to try to stop anything. The Express News is citing in the appellate record the record at 481 makes clear that no one stopped signatures. Signatures continued. The fact is they simply didn't gather enough signatures for purposes of getting this to the city secretary. There's a couple of procedural points I'd like to address with respect to Rule 329. So we made the point about the fact that it only applies to named defendants. We cite a case, Narmwal versus Waller ISD, which also explains that the idea of extending this process and allowing application of 329, and Narmwal specifically dealt with restricted appeal, which can be brought 6 months after. Other concepts, equitable bill of review can be brought 4 years after. These concepts are inherently inconsistent with what Chapter 1205 is trying to accomplish. The idea is to, with rapid, and the statute says, the least possible delay, decide the issue at the trial court level, decide the issue at the appellate level. And it is entirely inconsistent to allow these doctrines, such as restricted appeal, that would allow this process to go on for so long. 329 would allow a challenge up to 2 years after the fact, which the legislature, by including a provision in 1205 that says that any law inconsistent with the act shall not prevail, and in fact the act shall prevail over it, made a determination by the legislature that about 1205.
Well, what do we do with the plurality that says 329 applies? What do we do with that? Do we have to revisit it en banc, or since it's a plurality? Because there is the implication there, yes?
Well, Justice Rose said he's not deciding whether 329 applies or not, which is it makes it an interesting opinion to explore. There's also a timetable issue here in terms of appellate jurisdiction that I think means we don't have to decide the 329 issue. And let me address that. Mm-hmm. This is an expedited appeal. This is a direct challenge to the 1205 judgment, in particular terms of the 1205 judgment. It is an accelerated appeal. So to the extent the court believes the notice is proper, providing public notice, there's only 20 days after the signing of that judgment by which to file a notice of appeal. 15 days, of course, with extension. Mr. Riley admits his clients knew about the judgment within that period of time, 5 days before the expiration of appellate jurisdiction, if he had asked for an extension. Instead, they chose to file a 329 motion. A 329 motion is a motion for new trial. A motion for new trial does not extend jurisdiction with respect to an accelerated appeal. Under TRAP 26-1, the normal period is 30 days after the signing of a judgment. There's exceptions to that, and one of them is an accelerated appeal, which is strictly 20 days. There is no additional time period afforded simply because you file a motion for new trial. The motion for new trial was filed on February 23rd. 20 days after that would have been March 15th. 15 days allowing for an extension was March 30th. There was no hearing even on the motion for new trial at that point. The first day that we attempted to have looked at a hearing, I think, was April 1st. It ended up the hearing was held on April 28th. By that time, because of the operation of Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 306A7, if this court believes 329 can be applied, that reset the date of signing of the judgment as the date the motion for new trial was filed. 20 days after that is March 15th. If there are additional period of time, that would be March 30th. And so a notice of appeal was not timely filed, and this court does not have appellate jurisdiction with respect to this case.
Doesn't Rule 329 speak to the issue of whether the person is a party to the suit? Doesn't the person filing the 329, aren't they a party to the suit, or don't they have to be a party to the suit?
In our view, they must be a party to the suit. They have to be a defendant to be able to take advantage of that relief. And what we're saying here is that these parties, they never filed an answer. They never filed an intervention. If they had, they would have been subject to the bond requirement. And I think our view is that they circumvented that. But they never took any action to become a defendant such that they'd be able to take advantage of 329.
So do I understand you to be arguing that, notwithstanding all of that really cool stuff about ADJ and all that beforehand, ultimately we lack jurisdiction and this should be dismissed? Because ironically, everybody thinks that the courts don't have jurisdiction over this. I mean, I hear that on both fronts.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why we did file a motion to dismiss. It hasn't been disposed of, and it, in a sense, I think, is still pending here today.
It is.
On that ground. But we looked at the opinion of Justice Rose in particular, and we thought it was very important to deal with these issues of applicability, to deal with these issues of due process, because I know the court's going to take a close procedural look at 329, but we wanted to make sure that the court understood that we had done what the statute asked for and required.
We should have dismissed the suit if we want to get to the question of liberty, constitutionally protected liberty interest, should we?
I think Justice Rose took an approach very similar to that. That if you want to reach that issue, obviously the dismissal wouldn't provide that opportunity. But we do think that a plain reading of the rules, that there is not jurisdiction here. Okay. I think my time is up.
Thank you.
much time did I have?
Courtland, 7 minutes.
Fine. I wanted to first address the issue that came up a couple of times about whether they're standing with, or what is the standing of those who are proponents versus the regular members of the public. City of San Antonio says there's no difference, and at page 31 of our brief, we cite the Colson case allowing members of an unincorporated association promoting an amendment to sue to place the amendment on the ballot. Blum versus Lanier holding that a signet, these are Texas Supreme Court.
But is that the same thing as following the steps set out in, I think, 1205, right? Is saying that you can file suit, is that the same thing as following the steps to participate in this proceeding, assuming it is an EDJA?
What we're saying, Your Honor, is that the proponents of a charter amendment, and CPS in its argument does not seem to acknowledge that it was addressed, the lawsuit is addressed to the charter amendment. It's in the pleadings, it's in the evidence, it's in everything. The judgment itself addresses three aspects of the charter amendment: governance, term limits, ability to amend. It's directly attacking the charter amendment. It could be a valid attack after the thing passed by the voters. It's premature. That's the language of Justice Pope in Colson. It's premature to sue before the voters have weigh in on it.
So do you disagree that y'all did not take the necessary steps to properly intervene, post a bond, all that kind of good stuff?
Your Honor, it's in the record that there was no notice and there was no knowledge. And cases are replete with statements by the court saying, we realize that you don't actually have notice on a publication type thing. In other words, who reads that fine print? Have you seen these publication notices? They're hard to read. If you read it, you wouldn't know what it was talking about for the first, 1,000 words. So that's no notice, and that's the way the statute's set up, and it's in rem, and it's 25 days to get a judgment. But these proponents are in a situation, as in Colson, as in Blum versus Lanier, Brown versus Todd, Hunt versus Bass, people have standing when they have particular interest in the subject matter of the public suit, and especially this kind of a suit, where there's a constitutional right to seek these amendments. It was deliberately not notified. They were not notified so that there would not be the same challenge to this suit as there was to the San Antonio Water System Charter Amendment, which was blocked because the proponents inadvertently found out about it. This was after this suit. They found out about this and went to court and stopped it before there was a judgment. The trial court hears all the arguments and says, wait a minute, this thing's an advisory opinion. It's going against the political rights of these citizens.
Can I ask you a question? Who, in your opinion, how many people should have received?
How many what?
How many people should have received notice if you're sitting there?
Oh. How do you give notice? Yeah, that's something that the courts seem to say, what's reasonable notice?
And I think he's asking how many different parties, how many different persons, individuals should get right. notice.
Right, Your Honor, and I don't know the answer to that, especially when you have, say, 1,000 proponents. But if you give notice to, for example, Dr. Burns, he's one of the leaders, okay? And then you could go to court, and frankly, Burns would have responded. But if he doesn't, you can say to the judge, when Judge Sulik asked, have you guys notified the actual proponents of this? They said, well, we don't have to, Your Honor. And therefore, we didn't. But had they done so, there would have been the opposition. It would have blocked the suit. Because a trial judge who hears all the evidence of, or the cases against it, would not have gone forward. And then on page 21 of the brief is the actual statement about the significance of this right of the citizens. This is from Colson again, Justice Pope, talking about the exercise, the power of initiative and referendum is the exercise by the people of a power reserved to them and not the exercise of a right granted. And in order to protect the people of the city in the exercise of this power, Such charter provisions should be liberally construed in favor of the power reserved. It's an implementation of the basic principle of Article 1, Section 2 of the Texas Bill of Rights. All political power is inherent in the people. So, I mean, it's a pretty strong right stated by Justice Pope. We should have received the notice. This is not like just the general public. The government, what CPS has failed to respond to in their briefs and in this argument is, what is the reason they brought this suit? If they brought it to stop a charter amendment petition before it could become complete and before it could be submitted to the voters, that's illegal. They should not have done that. It's abuse of their power as the city.
If they were concerned about their bond ratings, would that be legitimate?
It would be, Your Honor, and this is what I'm saying, it's premature. Just as the Fitch rating said, this is a potential risk because they still have to get signatures and they have to get the people to approve it. And so, in other words, it might be. So let's say it passes, then you file your challenge. That's what happened in the Dieterman case. The Dieterman case cited to y'all by both sides, is a case where they passed a charter amendment that said, we're gonna limit you to 6% raises on your sales tax. On your property tax, and so the bondholders sued and said, "You're affecting our ability to collect on the bonds." But the thing passed the voters. Once it passed the voters, then there's a justiciable controversy.
Is there anything in the statute that says that they can't do? They can't file the action when they did? And if so, is that a question for the courts to consider, or is that something that we might want to take that across the hall to the legislature to have them clean that up if we don't think that that's a good policy decision on letting the city file preemptively?
The statute doesn't allow them to file preemptively, Your Honor. It doesn't. That's what we're 1205.021 doesn't include the reason that they give here, which is to go after this charter amendment, because it might affect their credit rating. Mm-hmm. It might affect, an impairment of contract, they say. These are potential risks. That's what the whole advisory opinion thing's about. And it's also, the second substantial reason is that you don't interfere with the political process while it's ongoing. You let it happen, and then if you've got an invalid legislative enactment, the courts are there for you.
At what point does the purpose of the EDGA become meaningless because so much notice is required that the publication requirement is defeated?
I think the publication requirement is correct, Your Honor. I think it is a proper way to go on proper 1205.021. Reasons. In other words, if somebody is saying, well, you didn't dot your I's when you issued those bonds, that's the proper case for an EDGA action. You didn't have authority. The bonds aren't legitimate for one reason or another. The money really in note. You spent the money wrong. That's the proper reason for an EDGA action. But when it's not a proper reason, you can't allow the issuing authority to come in and file one of these preemptive expedited matters on something that's not within the statute. Because look at what happens. You get a judgment to set aside a political movement in 25 days with no notice to anybody, actual notice. So
does this political movement stand on the same footing as the churches in Magnolia? Constitutional-wise.
I would say so, Your Honor. I'd say so. It's a liberty interest that is, as defined by Justice Pope, is under the Texas Constitution. This is a liberty interest to file these petitions, try to get these signatures, talk to your neighbor, try to get this thing debated and get before the public and try to make changes in your city government. That is definitely a right under the Texas Constitution. It should be protected in the same way as those the church was. Am I out of time again?
I think you are.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much.
And thank you all for a very enlightening argument. With that, the case will be submitted, and we are in recess.